The Guardian.
Hi, Leia Green here. And before you get started with this episode of Token, we wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, here's the show. Hi, I'm Leia.
Hello, I'm Freddie.
And welcome to our festive end-of-year episode of Token. We're joined by Mona Chalabi, the US data editor and producer and presenter of The Vagina Dispatches, a video series which talks about vulvas, not vaginas.
Honestly, I know this is really bad and it is my vulva and not my vagina, but I call it my vag.
Orgasms. Is a G-spot real? Did you find that out?
So the research is still inconclusive, but they think it's the inner part of the clitoris.
Yeah.
So it's just hitting like the inner part of the clitoris. Yeah.
And sex education.
I asked her what her sex education was like, and she said that her mum lifted up her top and showed her her belly button and was like, God gives a woman a child and the child is born through the belly button and then the belly button closes back up.
So, in the next two episodes, we're going to discuss all those things and much more besides and reveal our total ignorance along the way.
I can tell you how it started, which was just me and May going out to lunch and me saying to her, I don't think I know enough about my vagina, and it kind of going from there. And it was really interesting, actually, because
how did that come up?
Know me, Leia.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. We were just talking about bum holes before we started pressing record. I'm quite fascinated by like bodies, I guess. And so, yeah, we were talking about, it was really interesting because May's first reaction, I don't think this was necessarily a sincere reaction, but it was a way to try and force me to articulate why this series matters, was she pointed to the space between her nose and her mouth, you know, that ridge. And she was like, I don't know what this thing is called. Like, why does it really matter? And I was like, A, it's called your philtrum. And B, your vagina is different to that space, right? Like, it's complex, you know?
Yeah.
It has different emotional and physical and psychological components to it. And it's worth us understanding it. And I feel like it's messed up that I don't know that. I don't lie awake at night thinking, oh my God, is my philtrum okay? Not that I lie awake and I weren't worrying about my vagina, but you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And it's something that it's very common to not know anything about your vulva / vagina.
Which is what we've really, like, I've never ever, and this is going to sound like I'm being really tooting my own horn here, which I'm not, but honestly the reaction to it has been so phenomenal. Like, I've never ever produced any kind of journalism that's had a reaction like that, which is why we set up this inbox, because we knew that, like, you know, not everyone uses social media, which I think is something that journalists occasionally forget.
And what? Like, is live on Twitter.
And it's just really, like, honestly, the messages have been so incredible. And a lot of people saying exactly that they didn't understand this part of their bodies or this part of their partner's bodies or this part of their children's bodies, you know, and that it's important to understand this stuff.
I think it must have had that reaction because it genuinely was like, it's almost like you didn't realise that the space was there for it to happen. And then when it happened, it was like, oh, thank you. I just felt like grateful for you for making it, because I was just like you were both really honest. You spoke about stuff that me and I'm sure loads of other people think about, and it was just like, it's not just me.
Yeah.
Like, that is such a good feeling when it happens.
Yeah. So it was very frank, but you didn't have to be frank or sharing in order to benefit from watching it, because you guys had done that.
And right. Loads of people do things like that, but they're sort of the anonymous, like, presenters are like, oh yes, what does a normal vulva look like or whatever, but they never speak about themselves. But you guys were like in it, like really in it.
It would have felt weird not to, right? Like, it would have felt dishonest, especially for some of the subjects, all of the subjects we have direct experience of. So to not acknowledge that would have been super weird.
Before we continue, I just want to acknowledge the fact that there's quite a lot of alcohol on this table to sort of lubricate this discussion. Sorry, couldn't help it.
It's Christmas.
So we're talking about vaginas. And we also got bought presents by Mona, which are little flip mirrors, which are for looking at one's own vulva. And they have a vulva printed on the top, which I actually wanted to ask, whose vulva is this?
Oh, an illustrator drew this for us, a woman called Laura Callahan, who is incredible. She produces really, really beautiful stuff. But we did spend a lot of time looking at different vulvas and trying to pick one that we felt like was good.
And
what's a good vulva?
Well, good is anything that doesn't look like most typical representation. So obviously not all women look like this vulva, and not all people, sorry, look like this vulva. But it's a different representation. Like people need to see that, I think.
Yeah, totally.
It's kind of, just to describe it, it's kind of like, oh wait, I don't know
flappy.
How to describe it.
It's a bit flappy.
Bit flappy.
Yeah.
Flappy and happy. I feel really like hungover and weird. It's fine.
Can we talk for a second about the terrible slip up that I just made of saying women? Honestly, that's been really, really hard for me to not fuck up on regularly. You know, the very first line that we scripted, May and I, as heterosexual cis women, we both have huge blind spots. And the initial first line of the script was, oh, it's so bad. It was, all women have them, but most women have only seen their own. Or like, or
both
so,
untrue.
It's so bad. And then we were like, and porn, and lesbians, and like the trans community, and what are we doing? But yeah, it's like you constantly slip up, constantly. Yeah. Well, it's bad.
So if I can just be like devil's advocate for a second and ask why you were conscious of not wanting to speak like that. Like, I think it would still take quite a lot of people by surprise that you would be talking about people and not women when talking about vaginas.
Yeah, and I think that there were certain points when, especially when we were producing written material, it almost trips people up to the extent that I felt like, oh, maybe they're gonna like, you know, when it like really, really halts people's reading almost, because it sounds bizarre almost. But you know, just as a writer, that's something that you need to work at, so you restructure the sentence and you make it sound right. And because, you know, not only did we speak to interview trans people, we also received emails from people in the trans community, and it all of that really helps you stay focused, because in your minds you can see the people who you would be leaving out to use that language. So
it actually helps to hear from real people.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's just like, it's just it almost feels like a philosophy that you're aspiring towards without, you know, like speaking to those people really, really change things. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a series of interviewees you had throughout the series of little shorts. And how did you find them? And how specifically did you find that guy Harvey? Because when I saw him,
great,
I didn't expect
he?
You to actually interview a trans man. And I was like, I'm assuming he's a trans man.
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, respect. I would not be able to do that.
Really?
Even though I'm here talking about vaginas. Yeah. I think massive respect. Because I also realised that when I talk about this sort of thing, I have to be really conscious of how much I'm projecting my own insecurity on, and when I'm sort of talking on behalf, quote unquote, of the trans community, which I try not to do.
Yeah, but it's hard because even if you're not speaking on behalf of that community, most people listening to you will assume. Yeah, because
that's what you're doing.
They might think that they don't know anyone else from that community, or, you know. So we call them the Greek chorus, and we really, really wanted to have them because we didn't want to just have us inserting our own experiences in there and then experts. That's just not enough. And the other thing that we were really cautious of is that we didn't just want to have the trans man talking about trans issues and like the woman in the wheelchair talking about like disability issues, you know. And also to not introduce him every single time as a trans man.
Yeah.
He's just sharing his experiences, you know.
Yeah, which is cool. I think that might, even if that threw some people, they'd figure out in the end, you know. And they might actually go and Google some stuff, which is kind of always the glib response you give to someone who's interested in what's in your pants. It's like, you go and ask Google. Because you'll learn so much more from that than just from talking to me.
I think it was a hard decision for him, though, because he said, like, you know, this is what everyone is obsessed with.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm trying to explain, is there's more to being trans than this.
I mean, I felt that about doing this episode.
Really?
I was like trying to actually sit with why I was feeling uncomfortable rather than just be like, oh, no, I should be cool with this. It's totally fine. Well, then I realised it's not about talking about just what's in our pants, but like talking about pants and bits and genitals in general. It's also really valuable to talk about that sort of thing, because it is okay to talk about this stuff as long as the people talking about it are okay with doing it.
Yeah,
it's not that it's sort of out of bounds completely.
And providing that context, like you said, of talking about and being like, by the way, this isn't everything.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Yeah.
We've talked about enough stuff to like justify having an entire episode about vulvas at this point, I feel like.
I'm really nervous about talking about vaginas. Yeah.
I'm supposed to be the nervous one.
I know, I don't know.
But no, talk it through.
I think it's interesting.
I'll stop interrupting.
No, it's fine.
Tell us.
I just like don't want to make a podcast about my vagina and then like walk back into the office and everyone like listens to it.
Well, imagine fun. Yeah,
I know. And that's what I thought watching Vagina Dispatches was like, wow, like, do people look at you, you like thinking, are they thinking about my vagina right now?
Well, no, because I didn't show it. But it was interesting when we showed the pilot to Kath, who is the editor of The Guardian. The first thing she said to me is, you should show yours on the video if you really want to make a statement. And I was like, as it is, trolls on the internet.
Did you think about it?
Yeah, well, that's, yeah.
Did you think about it?
I did think about it, because I do actually think that would be really, really powerful and brave. But I also think, going back to what I was saying, which is that, and I think this is a bit of a pitfall for a lot of documentary making, is the way to get away from an existing narrative is to just tell one other narrative, and that doesn't really work. So to have just shown my vulva wouldn't have really helped to inform people about the real range that's out there. And so it was much more effective actually to have shown like snapshots of lots of different ones.
Yeah, it was really well done the way you did it, with that, exactly that sort of slideshow, or flickbook almost, like, sequence. And yeah, like showing yours would have just been a kind of almost like a shock tactic.
Yeah,
the personal stuff that you did include, which was like a really frank conversation with your mum, that was like, there was a real reason to do that, and it was what much more effective and sort of powerful, if presumably really difficult to do, no easier than showing.
It was nice. Leia filmed that. So Leia came with me to my mom's place, where my mom tried to force feed her for hours.
Her mom. We arrived and it was like, you know, we have a schedule.
Yeah.
And she was like, I have cooked all of the food in the world. And like, she made us sit down and eat. Like, it was so nice, but it was like,
it was tough.
Okay. Where's your mum? Where's your mum from?
Iraq. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. She made like a lamb stew.
Yeah.
Like some whole fishes.
Because
like
me and my
pasta.
Sister are vegetarian, so she like doesn't get to cook the good stuff for us. So when she had Leila was coming over.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was very wide ranging, really tough, because it lasted like maybe even 2 hours, and we ended up using about 3 minutes of it. Mm. Classic video.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I have a lot of respect for her, particularly after I went to Iraq, to actually see the kind of culture that she grew up in and how open-minded she must be as a person to have raised us the way that she did. So she talked about how, this didn't end up going in, about how I asked her what her sex education was like, and she said that her mum lifted up her top and showed her her belly button and was like, God gives a woman a child and the child is born through the belly button and then the belly button closes back up. Do you not remember that? You were so busy filming, I think. Yeah. So she was like, that was my education.
Wow. Like, so that's like pretending your vagina essentially doesn't even exist.
Yeah. And then my mum went into gynecology.
Wow.
But that was partly because there were so few women in Iraq at the time who were becoming doctors that they were all pushed to go into gynecology because, you know, men can't look at vulvas. See, the thing that's really interesting, May and I were talking about this, is a lot of these conversations assume that, like, your sex education is largely dependent on how open your parents are with you. But it's also about how much they know themselves, because they have whole blind spots, right? Which is why the conversation with my mum was quite interesting, because she doesn't as much as a medical practitioner. But I was talking to a friend of mine about this, and she said that she asked her mum how gay men have sex, and she was like, oh, one of them puts their penis in the other one's bum, and she was like, okay. And then she was like, how do gay women have sex? And her mum was like, don't know, I think they hug. And that was... And then so as I was making this, she texts her mum to be like, did you genuinely think that? Or and she was like, no, I only found out about dildos in the past couple of years. And she said that she only found out what gay men even did when she was 29, when she was in an office and someone made a joke about keeping your backs to the wall with this guy. And she was like, oh,
wow.
You know, like this generational thing. And her mum's really, really liberal. Like,
well, my mum's a real hippie, and I definitely was never taught anything by her, I don't think, like, sex ed-wise. I got that all at school, but that obviously doesn't include anything about masturbation.
But you would you want to talk to your mum about masturbation?
I'd like to have been told that it was a possibility.
But how can your mum communicate to you that that's a possibility?
I think that would be weird. I think that's like a lie.
But isn't that what happens with boys? Like, their dads tell them how to...
Yeah, but that's because they literally can't not. So it's kind of... I think that...
I don't think that's true. No. I don't think that's true. I really
that
don't think
it's
true. But they kind of tend to work that one out, I think. And then I think a conversation with a boy has to be like, it's fine. You know, like, don't be ashamed of this thing that you're doing. Like, everybody else is doing it too. Don't worry about it.
I think
it's not weird to talk about how to, like, healthily masturbate, to tell your kid how to do that.
I think one thing that's really, really important to say to kids now is it's okay to touch your body, but no other adults are allowed to touch your body. I think that's a really, like, your body is yours. You're allowed to do whatever you want with it. I think is a really great thing to say to a kid that kind of subtly implies
you can
masturbate. And the thing that's really interesting is speaking to a lot of females in the course of making this, a lot of them have said that as very young children, they masturbated. And at a certain age, which... As soon as you say it, so many, like, I don't want to insert myself into this conversation, but definitely relate to that. And then at a certain age, you just do somehow realise this is wrong or this isn't okay.
Yeah.
And then go by for years without doing it. And that's why I kind of disagree with you, because I feel like there are all of these subtle messages being told to us that that is a very dirty thing for a girl to do.
Yeah, I literally just cannot imagine talking to my mum about masturbating.
But don't you think if she just said, it's okay for you to touch yourself wherever you want to touch yourself as a young kid.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's the sort of counter messaging that's really damaging and insidious. And I don't think parents even realise, you just don't think about it. And it's not a conversation anyone would relish, but it's really important.
Mm. I guess, I think that's true, but I guess I draw the line at, like, technique implied in the conversation. If you had a conversation about technique, then they're just telling you about them, and I'm just like, bleh.
No, but they could, like, direct you to resources, perhaps.
Yeah, fine.
Resources?
Yeah.
Like, what kind
of
resources?
Like the internet.
Oh.
I think
that if you hadn't gone all of those years without touching yourself, then you would have had all of that time to figure some of this stuff out.
Yeah, that's true.
And like, Google shouldn't be telling you it. So much of it should just be you listening to your
intuitive
body and like,
yeah.
And I feel like that's what a lot of boys do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I don't know.
Totally. I don't think much has changed. I don't know. None of us have kids or particularly know young people, but I can't imagine suddenly people with vaginas today are being told this is okay.
Yeah.
No. I think it's probably got worse.
Really?
Probably, because there's no, like, what they do have is resource. They have much more porn and stuff, so they can see some things. And then I guess, like, if your sex education is porn, I know this is like a really, you know, well-trodden thing, but then it's almost like an instruction manual in itself. So you don't think, like, when you're working stuff out for yourself, you know, you might go down sort of 10 different paths or whatever, but if you're just copying something then and it doesn't work or you don't like it, then you're like, oh shit, like, maybe I don't like sex.
Mm.
Or maybe there's something wrong with me. So easy to think, especially about your genitalia, maybe there's something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you call your vulva?
Honestly, I know this is really bad, and it is my vulva and not my vagina, but I call it my vag.
Now, that is a good,
like,
word.
You call it
sound.
My vag. Yeah. Vag is quite a good word. You call it your vag, like, when you're talking to who?
Well, honestly, if you think about it, it was really interesting. We had a huge conversation about consent for episode 4, and it's so interesting how a lot of these conversations are deeply rhetorical, and actually in practice that's not the way things go. Like, very rarely in sexual situations do I refer to my vag. And just like consent, everyone sat around the table all nodding their heads very, very seriously about how it's very important to ask for consent, and I was like, you know, actually, let's be realistic, most people aren't going to say, like, pause.
Yeah.
You know, so it has to be about figuring other ways out that are a little bit more realistic.
Yeah. And there's a way that you can ask for consent you can kind of keep checking in, makes it sound like really lame, but you can do it in a way that's like, doesn't break the mood.
Yeah.
And it's like part of the foreplay / sexy time as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Like asking, do you like this?
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Is this good? Exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, that was a bit of a distraction. But yeah, I don't normally refer to my vag in sex.
Yeah.
I think vag is the closest I've ever heard to, like, the equivalent of dick. That's just, like, satisfying to say.
Mm. It also means you can do fun stuff, like during the vagina dispatches, we gave certain colleagues the vag of honour if they were very good. They really helped us out. You got a vag of honour.
Yes. Right, Leah. You'll go.
Fanny. But I would really not say that in a sexual situation.
What would you say? Have you ever referred to it?
No, but I think I might, actually, because I always think, what do I say, Fanny? Like, to my boyfriend? Mm-hmm. But no, you don't, because you don't need to. Everyone knows where it is and what's going on. Do you know what I mean? It's like, could you touch my fanny now? It's like, if you have to say that, it's not going.
It's not going well.
And that's my elbow. Like, you know, so I guess you don't really refer to it. But I say fanny, but I really hate that I say fanny. But is I do it, also do quite like the word.
Fanny for just in vaginas in general. Yeah. Not necessarily your own. Yeah.
Fanny. I quite like the word fanny, insult, but it is very infantilizing.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't use it as an insult.
I like calling people such a fanny.
I've never heard that.
That is a good insult. It shouldn't be.
I know, it's a trouble, but it's like a very such satisfying, a cutting sort of. Well, that's the thing. Is like if you want to sort of say someone's essentially like really silly and it's just such a.
It does sound silly,
dismissive.
Doesn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's bad.
So what about you, Fred?
No, don't ask me that. That's
well, you knew it was coming.
I know. Okay. I definitely don't think of my own bits as a vulva or a vagina. And that's not just, well, okay, I think there's two parts to that. I try not to like give you a whole lecture here, but like it's partly because of what the word signifies in our culture. So it's not so much about my own discomfort about my body, it's about my discomfort with what that word implies and what people start thinking about when they hear that word. Mm. Because that word is just synonymous with female. Mm. Female anatomy, and it's a word that we've invented to refer to the anatomy that we think females have. So it's just like you can't separate the two. Like if it was just a purely anatomical word like genitals, then I don't think I would have anywhere near as much of a problem with it. And then the other side of it is the fact that since transitioning for the last 3 and a bit years on testosterone, you know, that changes your body in a really like just a massive way all over. And so what my genitals feel like now is very different to what they felt like before. So I like can, you know, I think of what I have as my dick, like, and that's like really cool. But I also feel silly sometimes saying that, like, I don't usually talk about that unless I'm with other trans people or with my partner, because I feel like they're just going to be like, aw. You know, like, I feel like I feel stupid. Like,
what do you mean?
I wasn't expecting you to say really? That that's how they would react.
I know they don't react like that. I just think that's what they're thinking in their head. Because I feel like it's such a sort of, it's a thing that's like, means a lot to men. So if what I have isn't what people would also think of as when they think of what a penis is, then like I, it's just hard to explain. Like if you say it to another trans man, they totally get it.
Yeah.
And it's to do with how much more sexual I feel now, how much my libido is like huge, and like I can relate to the way people talk about male sexuality a lot more now than I used to be able to. And all these things, and orgasms are different, all these things like that.
I'm so tempted to ask you how. Can you answer that?
I'm really is actually going a little bit red right now.
Okay, I can mostly blame that on my genetics.
You tell me if you don't. I'm just going to really ask you questions.
Hey,
and then,
I'm going there, aren't I? Yeah. I mean, maybe this is something to do with the poor, and I'm probably going to regret saying all this. But I found it really helpful. There was an episode that you guys did about the shape of the clitoris. Mm. Like that was really
mind
eye-opening.
Blown.
Yeah, where it's like a wishbone shape. Mm. So if you can just imagine that, there's a lot. It's just like,
and that
the
gets
orgasm,
larger with testosterone as well,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah. And it's different for different people. And I'm not talking about myself when I talk about this, but generally testosterone enlarges the clitoris, and you can kind of see then you can start to see the kind of way back process of where a clitoris or whatever is that a fetus has either becomes a vagina or a penis. Which is really interesting, but it's basically just about that, like how testosterone affects that area, and orgasm kind of happens in a different place, and it just feels different.
To stay on that point for a second, my mind was truly blown when I watched these animated videos of how a fetus's genitalia does develop, to be able to map onto those two different bits and be like, oh my god, the inner labia and the testicles are made of the same material. That's why they have that texture. Whoa.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
clitoris is the penis. Whoa. Like the penile head. Like it was just so incredible to me to piece those two bits together. And it really changed my relationship with not only my genitalia, but with a partner's genitalia, and maybe even with my gender a little bit as well. Uh-huh. Like to really see, I don't know, to make those comparisons, like for like boom, 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 was just really amazing.
So when trans men have lower surgery, there's two different procedures you can have, but both of them involve a scrotoplasty, and they use the inner or outer labia.
Yeah, I think it's the inner labia.
To form
the testicles.
Testicles. Mm. That's why they look great. Yeah. It's a very successful procedure.
It's nice to reimagine that. The clitoral hood, I think that's the equivalent of the foreskin, yeah. Which is why it's so sensitive and why you should rub it in a similar way as you would rub a foreskin, which is you wouldn't just pull it back and like start rubbing the stuff that's underneath it, which is... Well,
Another thing that happens to trans guys early on when they're on testosterone is they have to start wearing different kinds of pants. Like, they have to find different underwear
because
it's really sensitive and uncomfortable for some guys.
Maybe I'm going to change to vag.
Yeah? Yeah. I mean, I still don't think vag is ideal. I think we need to come up with a word
what
that we feel...
What are there?
Because, again, vag is anatomically incorrect. Yeah. Like, it's It's really useful to differentiate between the external part of your vagina and the internal part, I think.
Mm.
We should actually all be better at communicating with our partners sexually about saying what we want. And to be able to say, you know... Oh, interacting with my vagina is completely meaningless. Whereas, as you said, to be like, focus on those inner cura of the clitoris, that's some useful information right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I ask a question about the inner clitoris?
Crura. They call it the legs.
Is that basically what a G-spot is, or is that totally different? Is a G-spot real? Did you find that out?
So the research is still inconclusive, but they think it's the inner part of the clitoris. Yeah. So it's just hitting like the inner part of the clitoris, yeah. Okay. Which makes sense, I guess.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, there is this also really, really difficult tension, I feel, which is between acknowledging that our bodies are complex and not acknowledging it. Because on the one hand, I feel like people are like, oh, vaginas are so complex, dicks are really, really straightforward. And I feel like that's really damaging. They're only complex because we haven't devoted the same time and resources to understanding them. And on the other hand, the more I learnt about it, I was like, oh, mind blown. They are kind of complicated. Yeah. And like the analogy that I make with periods is, on the one hand, I don't want to... I mean, part of what was so liberating to me about having the hormonal IUD where my period stopped was that I felt like I could be more like a man.
Mm.
It was truly liberating to me. And on the other hand, that's not really what like liberation is like, especially because most women around the world cannot just stop their periods like that.
Mm.
And we have to have a real conversation about the way that that genuinely impacts people with vaginas' lives, people with uteruses' lives on a daily basis. It's very hard. I feel like feminism hasn't really done a very good job of that. So much of feminism has just been, let's set aside everything that genuinely does make us different, you know, and just...
Yeah.
Campaign on the basis of being equals, whereas we needed to acknowledge some of those things, I think. And when I say feminism, obviously there's a million different strands, and I'm sure there's a strand of feminism that does do exactly what I'm saying, but it's not one that I was really raised engaging with.
Yeah.
For example, I want to be able to get ahead at work while saying I'm having a really bad period today.
Mm.
And I feel like I can't do that. The way to get ahead at work and be a badass bitch is to pretend that I've never had a period in my life.
Yeah. Do you get really like...
I never did. But I've spoken to a lot of people with vaginas who have. And, like, that's a genuine issue for people.
Sometimes I'm sure that it is. But I also think that the whole PMT thing, like, I don't actually know anybody that gets really bad PMT. And I almost feel like the way that it's used, you would think that most women go completely mental when they're on their period. But I think sometimes I think it's one of those things that you can just use as an insult. You know, it's just like, oh, good time of the month. And like, oh, careful, stay away from her for a week. Like, ah. But I don't really know anyone that like, I'm sure there
are.
Well,
maybe they don't talk about it because of those sorts of things that people throw
maybe.
Around. Like, it's equated with, like, insanity and hysteria.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that I'm publishing a Q&A with a doctor about periods, partly because that was the only episode that received a little bit of negative reaction of people being like, you know, you don't talk about all of the things that are positive about having a period. It's quite a negative message. So we really wanted to publish this Q&A.
Mm.
And the doctor mentioned something called menstrual psychosis, which is some people literally go a little bit nuts. And it's so cyclical that it is because of their menstrual cycle. Menstrual psychosis. And it's like, that's exactly what I first started thinking about feminism. Because I was like, I would never, ever, ever want to tell any men that this exists.
Right.
Because I'm just like, no. But it exists.
Exactly.
It exists.
Okay.
And we're doing a disservice to people who do suffer with that to just pretend it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. But we know that hormones like are really powerful things, and we talk about there's none of this shame associated with talking about roid rage or like it's just like
a roid rage.
Yeah, you know, like
what's roid rage?
Roid rage. Bodybuilders who abuse anabolic steroids.
Obviously, like it's not saying road in a weird way. I was like, trying to slide.
It's more like it's a sort of joke or a fascinating thing that happens to men who have like too much testosterone in their system, or testosterone in general being sort of linked to men being hyper aggressive. That's not a shameful thing. It's like, oh, isn't that interesting? Or like something that we have to help men with, maybe. But when it's the other way around, suddenly it's not okay.
And I've never even thought, genuinely, when you were saying that, I've actually never, ever, ever thought about men being affected by hormones in my whole life.
Whoa.
Well, let me tell you, testosterone is a powerful thing.
And I sometimes don't think of, okay, this is, I don't mean this literally, like I know that testosterone is a hormone, but like to me the word hormones is so synonymous with like moody stuff and women that I almost don't think, exactly, I almost don't think of testosterone as a hormone.
Mm.
It's just like men have testosterone, women have like crazy shit.
And I think it's because
women also have testosterone.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you forget that as well.
Yeah.
Mm. But it's partly because I don't even know if this is true. I should know this, but my assumption is that men's hormone levels are more constant, and it's because women's levels fluctuate that it's more of a thing. Is that even true?
I'm not sure on a monthly basis. All sorts of things can affect your testosterone level. Like if you listen to any
food.
YouTuber who talks about fitness, they'll be like, yeah, don't eat soya, don't do this, don't drink beer. It lowers your testosterone. But I don't know what that's based on. But certainly, you know, like men who have low testosterone for extended periods experience depression, all sorts of really sort of life impacting things that are normally associated with hormonal moodiness in women.
Apart from when men have babies, when someone gives birth and they're a father, the testosterone levels in men drop significantly, I think.
Yeah.
The what?
When a man becomes a father, their testosterone level drops.
Yes.
Mm.
So even if they didn't carry the child?
Yeah, so that they don't, like, kill the child.
I've heard that.
Wait. So when the child is born.
And as the person is pregnant.
But even if the child is born in another country.
I think you probably have to be.
Oh, okay.
You're like bonding with the baby.
But also, like, isn't that a similar thing to when testosterone levels dropping as men get older? Because it's associated with sex and reproduction, right? So you don't need as much testosterone when you're older because you're not reproducing.
It'd be nice for old men if they just like kept it though, just for a laugh. I think it would be quite depressing to not ever want to have sex.
Well, in depending on
why are you making that?
Because I'm like the sweet liberation of being able to just, I don't know, work all day.
What?
That is so sad. Oh no.
This is why I'm single, isn't it?
I don't know. Stop looking at me like I know. I don't know.
So that's the end of part one of our vulva special. Join us in part two where we get really personal about orgasms, periods, and pigeons.
If anybody knows where my G-spot is.
Anyone knows where Leia's G-spot is, you can email podcasts@theguardian.com. Leia is tweeting at Leia Green Tweets. I tweet at Fred McConnell. Subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes, SoundCloud, Audio Boom, Mixcloud, all the rest, your podcatcher of choice. Our producer was Rowan Slaney.
Till next time, bye.
Bye-bye.
Someone's going to set up a Tumblr. Where is LeiaGreenTweets.com?
It might need its own Twitter account, actually.
So just suggesting locations.
Have you got one?
A Tumblr or a G-spot?
G-spot doesn't exist.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't think it exists.
Okay. Oh, well, fine. Okay, that's good to know.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Hey, Freddie McConnell here. And before you get started with this episode of Token, we wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.